This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. The House of Representatives passed a sweeping set of voting rights measures known as H.R. 1, or the For the People Act. The bill includes measures like automatic registration for eligible voters, the elimination of voter ID requirements, and mandating the drawing of district lines. But voter rights are on the docket in local governments, too, including in Georgia. The Georgia State House passed its own bill, one that ramps up voting restrictions. It's one of more than 250 bills that state lawmakers have introduced to tighten voting rules across the U.S. Here to talk about the future of voting access in Georgia and beyond is Democratic Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock. Senator, welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
So H.R. 1 just passed the House. It's heading to the Senate, but it's expected to face an uphill battle. And in this case, there are no budget restrictions to keep Republicans from a filibuster. Do you think this bill is too partisan to pass the Senate?
This bill is not partisan at all. It is about the very foundations of our democracy. This bold and noble experiment we call America, this experiment in self-governance. Your vote is your voice. Your voice is your human dignity. This should not be viewed as just one other bill alongside others. This is foundational. Whatever it is we're arguing about in our democracy, whether it's guns or butter, it's about health care or war, at the end of the day, the people have to know that their voices are being heard in their democracy. And what we are witnessing weeks after my historic election and historic voter turnout in November and in January is a shameful effort by politicians to steal the voices of the American people, to reverse what it means to live in a democracy such that the people, rather than the people picking their politicians, the politicians get to pick their voters. I think it's shameful, it's anti-democratic, and I'm going to do everything in my power to resist it.
If Republicans do filibuster the bill, which seems extremely likely, would you take that as evidence that the filibuster needs to be done away with?
Well, we certainly know that the filibuster has a history that's steeped in America's struggle with race in this country. Those who were trying to push civil rights bills in another era came up against this. It was used often as a tool to prevent progress. I have to say that given the urgency of this moment, the ways in which clearly, there are those in my home state of Georgia and across this country who are trying to make it harder rather than easier for people to vote, that all options have to be on the table.
So what I hear you saying is this is a bit of a litmus test for whether you think the Senate can function with the filibuster in place.
Yeah, I think all options just have to be on the table. I mean, here we are in March of 2021. This coming Sunday is the actual anniversary of Bloody Sunday. And Bloody Sunday when John Lewis and others, and he used to say, and he was my church member, I had the honor of being his pastor, he used to humbly say that he gave a little blood that day. We know he gave a lot more in terms of the arc of his whole life. And here we are on the anniversary of Bloody Sunday in 2021. And there are those who are trying to take us back to the other side of March of 1965. And it seems to me that Americans of all races, regardless of whether you're a Democrat or Republican or an independent, ought to stand up and say that at the end of the day, let's have the arguments. But after the arguments are heard, the people's voices, the foremost powerful words in a democracy is the people have spoken. And I just have no tolerance for people for politicians trying to steal the voices of the people.
We got this tweet from Kokomo Kid who says, can the Dems get sufficiently organized to overcome the Republicans' voter suppression efforts? And I think he's speaking there to the fact that there are some in your own party who are reluctant to do away with the filibuster, which would clear a path to passing things like H.R. 1. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that we will have some important conversations about this in the days ahead. there's more, you know, there are various ways we could move forward, but we must move forward.
What are some of those conversations you're having right now in your party, specifically this issue of voter suppression?
Look, we will figure out the way forward. And what's clear to me is that years from now, generations from now, our children and our grandchildren are going to ask us, what were we doing while our very democracy was being attacked? I mean, we saw this in a crude and crass way on January 6th, when people literally at the suggestion, more than suggestion of a president, people sacked the Capitol. And what were they doing? They were trying to stop the certification of an election in which dozens of judges had already resisted the overtures of the Trump administration, saying that it was illegitimate. And even in this moment, you've got the former vice president and others trying to delegitimize the election. This is an assault on our democracy. And it cannot stand.
Part of the debate on this issue is whether it's the place of the federal government to weigh in on voter laws. A Republican Representative Andy Biggs of Arizona had this to say on the House floor.
Democrats will permit ballot harvesting and mandate nationwide mail-in balloting, which Jimmy Carter himself said is a recipe for fraud. Democrats are so enamored of power, it appears that they want to legalize cheating in elections. And if that isn't enough for you, they want 16-year-olds to be able to register to vote, as well as felons to also be able to vote, and illegal aliens. What could possibly go wrong? While most of the country has some doubt as to the integrity of our elections across both parties, my colleagues across the aisle want to ensure that we never have an honest election again. This bill is a dubious path on which they wish to embark.
Why do you feel it's necessary for the federal government to step in here and implement voting legislation?
Listen, where would we be without the 1965 Voting Rights Act? That was federal legislation. We are one country at the end of the day. And so we have to have some baselines at the national level. And, you know, this lie about widespread voter fraud, that didn't start this year. They've been telling this lie for years with no evidence. Voter fraud in our country is virtually non-existent. It certainly hadn't swung any elections. And we saw that in the rulings by the judges as the Trump administration or the Trump campaign put forward their cases over the last few months. There was no evidence of this. The fraud is this lie that's being promulgated even in this moment, that somehow the election of 2020 was stolen. And, you know, this would be laughable were it not for the fact that five Americans lost their lives. This is dangerous and deadly stuff. We've got to stand up in this moment. We cannot stand.
In your home state of Georgia, nearly 80 bills and resolutions about voting have been filed in the Georgia General Assembly just in 2021. And I'm curious to hear what you think it's going to happen in your state. Georgia still has a Republican state legislature, despite going blue in the Senate runoffs and the presidential election. Is there any way for your party to challenge these state laws?
Yeah, the way to do that is through the federal law. We have got to pass the For the People Act, and I'm glad that that was the first bill that my name is on as a co-sponsor. I do it in memory of John Lewis, who was my parishioner. I was his pastor. I do it in memory of Martin Luther King Jr. I do it in memory of Schwerner and Cheney and Goodman, two Jews and an African-American who lost their lives, spilt their blood fighting for the vote. This is the least we can do. And shame on us if we don't stand up in this American moment and say we're a democracy.
A Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has argued that H.R. 1 is just congressional Democrats imposing their will over the will of state and local governments. What's your response to that assertion?
We're going to pass the For the People Act so that it's easier for people to vote and not harder. And we're going to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. When the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013. The argument was that the formula was outdated and was no longer needed. And the ink on that decision was barely dry when states like my state of Georgia, not the state, but certain politicians in the state, quickly began to create these restrictions on voting. I think what people should be asking these politicians is, why are they so afraid of the voters? People who have confidence in their message trust the voters. And clearly they know that their message is not a winning message. And so they're trying their best to change the rules. It cannot stand. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure we pass the For the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act.
That's Democratic Senator Reverend Raphael Warnock of Georgia. Senator, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we take a deep dive into the contents of H.R. 1, and we travel across the U.S. where voting restrictions are popping up like wildfire.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
The House of Representatives passed the For the People Act, mostly along party lines. But despite the federal push to expand voter access, things look pretty different at the state and local level. We spoke about election security and voting rights in Georgia, but the Supreme Court is currently hearing two cases concerning voter laws in Arizona, and its rulings could chip away even further at the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Here to talk about the state of voter access in the U.S. is Jessica Huseman. She's the editorial director of VoteBeat. That's a nonprofit newsroom covering election integrity. Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Also with us, Andrea Benjamin, an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma. She's also the author of Racial Coalition Building in Local Elections, Elite Cues and Cross-Ethnic Voting. Andrea, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Andrea, you were listening in on our conversation with Senator Warnock there. Did anything jump out to you?
Yeah, he had a lot of really great things to say. I think the number one thing is that voting is the voice of the people. And I think the question that we should all be asking ourselves is, what is the value or the importance of trying to limit people participating in our election process?
Jessica, what exactly is in H.R. 1? We've talked a bit about what it aims to do, but how does it aim to do it?
So it aims to kind of standardize the voting process across the country and ensure that people have the same access in any state, regardless of where they are. It also sets out some requirements for local areas to, for example, get new machines that meet a certain level of standards by a specific year, or use specific supplies, or design their ballots in a certain way to ensure that people have access to the ballot and understand it as well as anyone else across the country. I think in those specific requirements is where the bill, in my mind and in the mind of election administrators, does not do a very good job representing reality. Mm-hmm. Even if there are fantastic goals in there and the overall aim of the bill, you can't really disagree with. There are pieces of the bill that will be very, very difficult for election administrators to implement. And I think that that's an unfortunate piece of this legislation.
I want to dig into that a bit more. But first, Andrea, a significant chunk of this bill also targets partisan gerrymandering. Can you break down what's involved there?
Sure. I think one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, I think regardless of who draws the lines, the people who draw the lines draw them to ensure their own reelection. And so I think that's what makes it hard, is I think both sides have done this. And so, you know, moving to an independent process to draw the lines does seem to be a good idea, although I think the research suggests that there still will be some bias. But I think that is one thing, right? We know that there's been, you know, cracking of districts so that they can break up voting blocks, or packing of districts, ensuring that only, you know, one district in the state can elect a Democrat or what have you. So I think it's a really important issue. And I think at the state level, people are obviously talking about this right now. So it could be that a national policy might help add clarity and, again, uniformity across all 50 states.
Now, Jessica, you were talking about election administrators and some of the challenges this bill presents for them. I think this past election was a huge lesson for many of us, especially after the wave of mail-in voting during the pandemic. What are election administrators saying they need from the federal government?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing is that election administrators were not at all consulted in the drafting of this bill. So there are requirements that they must meet that they literally cannot. So, for example, H.R. 1 requires that that election administrators purchase new machines that comport with a bunch of new standards in 2 or 3 years. And those machines will not even exist in 2 or 3 years. They can't possibly. So the bill sets election administrators up for failure. The bill also does a lot of strange things. Like, for example, at first, the bill required that election administrators use self-sealing envelopes, which cost about 30% more than normal envelopes and also get stuck in the USPS's sorting machines because of the way that they're manufactured. I genuinely don't know what problem that's supposed to solve. But it will, in fact, create a lot of problems. The bill now reads that election administrators should do something like make all like efforts or something to institute self-sealing envelopes, but that they won't. I mean, because the self-sealing envelopes are just simply not a good idea. They will make voting worse. So there are just little bits of things in there like that. And then, you know, this is also not a, this is a bill that does not necessarily apportion funding to them. There will need to be a separate conversation about the distribution of funding to election administrators. So this bill says, well, you should get this much money to make these things happen, but that's an entirely separate conversation that will not be part of passing this bill. And so if they require election administrators to do all of these things and then the funding does not follow at the rate that it should, then this bill becomes an unfunded mandate and requires election administrators to make massive changes to their system without much financial support.
I want to play this message we got from Nina in Tallahassee.
This was the safest, most secure election in history, the experts say. And what appears to be happening is the Republicans know that if everybody's allowed to vote, they're not going to win. So it just looks pure and simple to me like voter suppression. And how can they justify making these more restrictive rules? I mean, I just don't get it.
Andrea, how would you answer Nina's question? What is the justification for making it harder to vote?
I can't say that I disagree with Nina. She's right on, spot on with her observation, right? We know that the election was deemed to be very secure. I think one thing to think about is sort of that we have three levels of government. And so while at the federal level, the Democrats did do quite well, we know that Republicans were still overwhelmingly reelected and elected to state legislatures. And we know that voter turnout in local elections remains extremely low. So I think that there is this perception that Republicans sort of are sour grapes, I guess is how we would say it. And so they're sort of combating that. But at most state legislatures are majority Republican. And so they are able to win at that level. And so in some ways, maybe this is them protecting that win and protecting those legislatures. But I think that, you know, the question remains, you know, why are you trying to reduce the number of people that have access to the ballot? And I think really trying to get at the heart of that question is really important, because as the caller said, you know, it seems as if they're trying, you know, that they understand that as more people access the ballot and participate, they are not going to be the winners.
Well, Jessica, I mean, not to be depressing, but when it comes to election security, allegations of voter fraud, politically speaking, How much do the facts matter when compared to public perception? Because even Republicans who resisted Trump's claims of election fraud will say that because of widespread mistrust among their voters, something must be done. Talk about that tension.
I don't think that facts matter at all. I think that the Republicans have wrapped themselves up in this scenario in which they want themselves to be viewed as the party of election integrity, and they want the Democrats to be viewed as the party that wants illegal immigrants and felons to vote. They want people to believe that the Democrats don't want their vote to count. They want them to believe that they want it to be canceled out by people who should not vote and have no right to. And that does not reflect reality. It does not reflect the facts on the ground, but it is a great motivational tool for Republicans to turn out their base. And so I think that, you know, certainly there is power in literally disenfranchising people who would not vote for you. But I think that in the minds of the Republicans, there is far more power in convincing their base to turn out on the basis of election integrity. That has been a gigantic rallying cry for the Republican Party for quite a long time. It is incredibly politically effective. And so they're sort of killing two birds with one stone in terms of making it so that Democrats can't turn out to vote and ensuring that Republicans do.
What does the data tell us about election security in the U.S. right now? For instance, Jessica, do we know if requiring photo ID for mail-in ballots, for instance, actually does decrease the level of voter fraud?
Well, I mean, given that the rate of voter fraud is so incredibly low to begin with, it's sort of hard to say. I mean, like, does voter ID reduce the number of fraudulent votes cast by 2 or 3, maybe. It's almost impossible to say because the numbers are so small, right? They're trying to solve a problem that meaningfully doesn't exist. And so making the system worse or less accessible in order to prevent a small handful of votes that would be fraudulently cast seems like a fool's errand to me. It seems to me that we are preventing more people from voting in these concepts than would be voting fraudulently, if anyone was voting fraudulently at all. So I think that, you know, asking whether these bills effectively solve a problem that doesn't exist is a question that's difficult to answer. And I think that that is what the folks who are writing and passing these bills rely on, that there isn't really a clear answer either way. And you know, you can't say, oh, well, this bill improved the problem this much. But you also can't really say this bill worsened the problem by this much, because there are 100 different reasons that people don't vote. And turnout is not a great way to measure whether or not a bill is particularly harmful, because there are also 100 reasons people do or do not turn out. So it's just a difficult question to answer. And I think that the Republicans know that, and that's why they are able to sort of skate this thing through in a lot of confusion.
Andrew, we got this email from Jeff who says, everyone needs an ID for every aspect of life. The notion that poor Black people are incapable of acquiring an ID is about as racist an idea as I've ever heard. But this excuse is always given for not requiring voters to show something they already have and use every day. Can you respond to that email?
Sure. I think, yeah, we are used to using our ID for lots of things. But I also think that voting, you know, as Jessica said, there are lots of reasons why people don't vote. And I think that for me, at least, adding another barrier is just unnecessary. And we also know that the hours that the DMV or the ID office are open can be restrictive for some people. If you work an alternative work schedule, or you also work 8 to 5, when are you supposed to go get a new ID if yours should expire? These are all things. And again, sure, we might do that in our regular life, but to just add it as an additional barrier to voting, especially when we know that people aren't really showing up with fake IDs to vote, right? People use fake IDs for more fun activities than voting, right? And so I just think, you know, it's really hard, because I understand what he's saying. Sure, if I want to purchase something, I usually have to show my ID, but voting is a fundamental right. And I just don't think that there should be barriers when you have to show up, you give your address, there's a extremely strict tracking system. You sign your name. You have to know your current address. I'm not carrying around 15 addresses in my mind with fake names associated with them so that I can move from polling place to polling place on election day. There are already a lot of, you know, steps in place to make sure that we don't vote more than once, that we don't vote fraudulently. So adding the idea is just another barrier. And I just, again, think to myself, if you have a great platform and you are the better candidate, you should be able to win based on that. You don't need to make a bunch of restrictions that make it harder for your opponent to win. And to Jessica's point, that sort of encourage one side to show up because they're the ones that are protecting the sanctity of voting, and the other side doesn't show up because there are barriers that prevent them from being able to do so.
Well, I want to quickly pivot to SCOTUS. The Supreme Court is hearing two voting rights cases based on racial discrimination at the polls. Jessica, explain the cases being heard in the court right now.
Right. So, you know, I think that the one that's most important in my mind, and I'd love to hear what the other guest has to say about this, the second one, is the one that's coming out of Arizona. And there was a hearing yesterday on this, and the justices, I think, seem very eager to allow these bills in Arizona to stand. And one of them is about ballot, is about what Republicans love to call ballot harvesting, which is someone that is not you turning in your ballot for you. There is a law in Arizona that would require you to, that would ban anyone but members of your immediate family from turning your ballot in on your behalf. And there have in the past been pretty horrific incidents of ballot harvesting in places like nursing homes or hospitals, for example, in which activists sort of compel people to hand them their ballot and cast it in a specific way. But there are more obvious ways to fix that problem than making it so that no one can turn in your ballot but your immediate family, because this puts folks like, for example, people living on Native reservations at a real disadvantage, because the mail does simply not work the exact same way in all places as it does for you and I, right? Dropping someone else's ballot off at the post office to mail it in is pretty much exactly how people on these reservations access the mail. The mail is quite far away. It's not very accessible. This is also similar for rural communities who do not have as immediate access to the USPS as perhaps people who live in suburbs or urban areas do. So it does put folks at a real disadvantage. And this bill, the hearing that happened yesterday also made clear that the justices are eager to talk about the applications of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act in its entirety. And Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is the portion of that bill that bans discrimination based on race or gender or ethnicity in voting. And so if we limit the ability for people to bring cases under Section 2, then that's going to have a really disproportionate impact on minorities in this community who can now no longer access the exact same judicial resources that they once had under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And I think that could spell quite a bit of trouble in the next few years, especially since we're seeing so many draconian bills moving through the legislature right now.
And emails, I find it appalling in the greatest democracy in the world that we have representatives in both state and federal congresses actually trying to make it harder to vote. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
In recent mass shootings, people have been targeted for who they are or who they worship. But on June 28, 2018, people were targeted for the job they do at a newspaper. Listen to the new series from NPR's Embedded about the survivors at the Capital Gazette.
Now let's get back to our conversation on voting rights. Andrea, I want to hear your thoughts about the cases before the Supreme Court. But first, it's worth taking a listen to this exchange from the Supreme Court between an attorney representing the Arizona GOP and Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Now, Justice Barrett wanted to know a justification for making it more difficult to vote in Arizona.
What's the interest of the Arizona RNC here in keeping, say, the out-of-precinct ballot disqualification rules on the books?
Because it puts us at a competitive disadvantage relative to Democrats. Politics is a zero-sum game.
Andrew, what did you make of that exchange?
I think it's a good question, right? So what is the value of doing that? But I think the lawyer is correct. They are at a disadvantage. And, you know, again, maybe going back to Senator Warnock's point, sort of that it is a zero sum, or even this lawyer's comments, is a zero sum game. So the question shouldn't be, how can I change the rules to make it easier for me? Or to the senator's point, how can I change the rules so I get to pick my voters? The question should be, what can I do to be more competitive? Right. That's really what's at stake here. Is this is an election. You're supposed to talk about the things that you want to do, the policies you want to implement, what you want to bring to the table, and the voters are supposed to decide. And if you're saying, I can only win when less people are allowed to participate, that's just troubling to me from a Democratic, you know, sort of normative standpoint.
The 1965 Voting Rights Act blocked discriminatory voting practices, something widely practiced in southern states to keep black voters from the polls. If these cases are successful, Andrea, what do you think it would mean for voters?
I think it will make an activity that is already not everyone's favorite activity less popular, right? And I think that, again, is just something that's deeply troubling to me just as a person. And so I think we really do have to be diligent and on this point, and we cannot let these restrictive policies pass, because all it's going to do is make people less likely to vote. And again, we did have high turnout in 2020, and that was great, but it's not usually even that high. And so even again, to Jessica's point, I think that they are trying to make a problem out of something that doesn't exist. And I can see why that's appealing, but I think long-term it is destructive, and it is extremely problematic for the state of our democracy.
Stephen tweets, voting is a constitutional right, and nowhere does it say you need an ID. Driving a car, flying in a plane, checking books out of a library, renting an apartment, etc., are not constitutional rights. Jessica, let's say that these bills in Republican-controlled state legislatures pass and increase restrictions to voting. Then let's say H.R. 1 also passes. How do we have working elections with all these differing voting requirements?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I would love to be able to give you a better answer for that. I think that, the Supreme Court cases that are being considered will really change the way that we interact with the Voting Rights Act, especially Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and really change up our definition of what we believe to be discriminatory practices, which I think is a problem in and of itself, especially given the 2013 Shelby County decision that removed the requirement for preclearance or sort of the approval of voting changes within the federal government. And then we're also going to have laws that would, for example, make it harder for you to get the relief that you can now get, which is just by suing. And so if we cannot both prevent these laws from being enacted, and then we cannot sue based on their disproportionate effects on minorities accessing the ballot box, then we're in a pretty sticky situation in terms of giving people their constitutional right to vote in an accessible and equitable way. And then if we layer H.R. 1 on top of that, which certainly does have some additional protection for voters, which are really fantastic. And I don't mean to suggest by throwing cold water on portions of H.R. 1 that I think the entire bill is a bad idea. I certainly don't. There are sort of inarguably excellent things in this bill, but there are also things that would make voting harder for election administrators to pull off. And so if we introduce difficulty in resolving conflicts and we also introduce difficulty in putting on the vote in the first place, then we find ourselves in a very difficult place. And I think one that election administrators themselves will find untenable.
Well, Colleen emails, I would like to know the authors of the HR bill you are discussing. It amazes me the arrogance of politicians who write a bill that mandates things that they do not fund or do not exist. Jessica, who are the authors of this bill?
Well, there are quite a few of them. So it's sort of difficult to answer that question directly. There have been quite a few prominent Democrats that have championed this bill and that have sponsored it and that have co-sponsored it. The Democrats have made this their top legislative priority this year, and so there are quite a few sort of hands in the pot. And I think that the fact that so many people have touched this bill is actually what has made it a bit of a mess in my mind. There are lots of different interest being served in this bill, and one of them is unfortunately not the efficacy of voting and the possibility of implementing some of the more specific election administrative pieces of this bill. Certainly there were activist groups that were consulted about this bill. They should have been. That is what they do. They study voting. But I don't think that there is much of a justification for not contacting election administrators and making sure that this bill is realistic.
Chris tweets, I'm a Michigan voter, and I thank the Secretary of State for mailing the application for absentee voting to me. Absentee voting allowed me to sit down with my ballot and search each candidate at home at my leisure, making sure the people I voted for represented me to the fullest. Andrea, when you look back at the 2020 election, what stands out to you in terms of voting rights? What lessons do you think we learned?
Yeah, I think the previous comment, it stands, right? I mean, that's one thing. I mean, I study local elections, and the one thing we know is that people are not paying attention to them at the same way that they do to these national elections. And so, yes, the thought of being able to spend a Saturday afternoon doing your research, figuring out for each race which candidate is best for you, that sounds ideal. I don't know if it's realistic for most people, though. And so we look at community organizations, political action committees, local political action committees that try to do some of this heavy lifting for voters, whether that's them sending some type of voter guide. You know, my students made a voter guide for our local elections earlier in February, and we hoped that it was helpful to people. It's unclear, whether or not they sent out a slate of endorsements. Or I know in California this year with all of the ballot initiatives, there were organizations that sort of ran down each initiative and sort of tried to explain the pros and cons. So I think that is important. But even more than that is if you yourself just don't have the same access to the ballot, you don't have the same amount of time, I think that absentee voting is a way to allow you that flexibility to do that research. But even just, you might not be able to take Tuesday off to go vote. And even here, our state legislature lifted our requirement last year for the full, for sort of COVID on to, we have to get our absentee ballots notarized. And so even though the notary doesn't charge you, and there are several, a lot of community organizations, again, people on the ground doing the work will offer free clinics, but even that's time prohibitive, right? That I have to go to a notary to then get my ballot notarized so that you know that it's valid. These are all just restrictions. So I think 2020 was a great example of what happens when people have sort of tuned in, they had the time, they were able to use absentee voting, for health and safety reasons, probably in the number one reason. But it also shows, look at the turnout, right? It was so high compared to other elections. And so I think people want to engage with voting, I think when they're interested. But again, when we have these barriers, all it does is reduce people's interest. People are not going to do all the work that it would take to overcome every hurdle. And so again, the question remains, why are the hurdles here?
We got this question on Twitter from Jay Bell, who says, can anything be done to fix some issues by executive order? Jessica, with H.R. 1 hanging in the balance, is there an executive order that could fix some of the issues we've seen with voting?
I struggle to think of a executive order that would allow that. I mean, I think that what's important for people to understand is that the Constitution is essentially silent on the mechanism for voting and who can do it, right? Of course, we have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that ban discrimination based on race or gender, but we do not have, the Constitution does not spell out exactly how elections must be administered or how they must be funded or much of anything at all about who should vote and who shouldn't vote. And so I think that there is a misunderstanding on the part of the American people as to how vocal the Constitution is about voting. And given that the federal government has almost no direct authority over voting except for in federal elections, and even then, their authority is not very great. I think that people think that the federal government has more responsibility and influence over elections than it actually does. In fact, states and even counties make the vast majority of decisions on how elections are administered and run. And so if an executive order were to be put out, I don't know that it would have much force. And then also, it likely would not work in every state in the exact same way, because every state approaches these issues in very, very different ways. And so I think that in order for there to be a well-reasoned solution nationally to this problem, so I think it is going to require sort of deeply researched federal legislation that gives quite a lot of funding and gives quite a lot of flexibility to states to achieve broader goals. And that is just really not the historical way in which executive orders have been understood. So this is really going to require a bill like H.R. 1 to set minimum standards for states. Unfortunately, I think that H.R. 1 is not that bill.
We got this tweet from Juji, who says, what's the best thing common citizens can do to combat the ongoing lies about election fraud? Jessica, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that you just need to engage the people that you know who believe these things and show them what the actual facts on the ground are. And if you have those sort of dynamic conversations with people that you know who believe these lies, then that's the best thing to do, because certainly they trust people that they know more than they trust the national media or their national politicians who are disagreeing with them.
So I'm curious to hear from both of you what changes in voter rights laws you think we'll see before the next election. Andrea, I'll come to you first.
Hopefully, you know, I agree with Jessica that there are some challenges to H.R. 1, and obviously we would hope that there would be a funding package to help states implement these policies. But I think, you know, having a uniform system whereby I don't have to call my friends in another state and they're allowed to early vote for, I don't know, 8 weeks beforehand and I get one day, you know, just to have some uniformity. Again, I don't think that we need to have ID laws for vote. You know, there doesn't need to be voter ID laws, and we need to really work on reducing the restrictions that prevent people from accessing the ballots. So those are my thoughts.
Jessica, your thoughts, especially when we see how partisan this issue has become.
Absolutely. You know, I think that the most crucial thing in my mind is getting more funding to local election administrators. I think people underestimate the number of people who are unable to vote simply because their county is not well-resourced enough to provide adequate polling locations or adequate poll worker training. And so a lot of the problems that we see with direct disenfranchisement because of mistakes made would be solved if these counties were better resourced. And so I'm hopeful that that some of these bills at least will result in more direct disbursement of funds to local election administrators.
That's Jessica Hoosman. She's the editorial director of VoteBeat, a nonprofit newsroom covering election integrity. Also with us, Andrea Benjamin, an associate professor at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Racial Coalition Building in Local Elections, Elite Cues in Cross-Ethnic Voting. Jessica, Andrea, thanks to you both. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.